Happy New Year. I'm Nicholas Barrett.
I'm Maria de Merites.
I'm Nicholas Potier.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. Last Friday, Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Overseas Force, was killed by an American airstrike outside Baghdad airport.
Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qasem Soleimani.
The Ayatollah was not pleased, and Tehran has promised to retaliate. At the time of recording, the world is still waiting to see how Iran might respond. Some have speculated they could disrupt the world's oil markets by closing the Strait of Hormuz, which acts as a vital artery for around a third of the world's liquefied natural gas and almost a quarter of the world's oil.
Fallout of the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani by the US has widened. Oil prices are near an eight-month high.
While the oil price is spiking following the death of Iran's top general.
And oil back on its roller coaster, with the Middle East crisis deepening fears of supply.
Oil prices went above the $70 mark for the first time in more than 3 months.
Today, oil prices surpassed $70. And if tension escalates further, the price is bound to grow. So, how dependent is the global economy on affordable Middle Eastern fossil fuel? Before we talk about the current crisis, let's talk about the last time the West was caught off guard. Maria, tell us what happened in the 1970s.
Indeed, we had similar picture back in the 1970s. They had two distinct oil crises, one in 73 and one in 79. Both were motivated by events in the Middle East, primarily hostilities in the Middle East. In 1973, there was an Arab embargo, an Arab league of the countries that export oils, towards a number of countries that were supporting at the time the war between Israel and Arabs. And that affected a number of countries, including the UK, the US, but also other smaller countries across the world. The effect of that was that they were not allowed to import oil from the producers in the Middle East. And that caused, of course, a demand for oil that could not be fulfilled. And therefore, they translated into a huge increase in the price of oil globally, since oil is a commodity that is traded at the global scale. A similar thing happened also in 79, the second oil crisis. The 70s were turbulent times when it comes down to this, this time motivated by the Iranian Revolution, and this time the effect was on a direct reduction of the supply of oil, which has basically the same effect as far as prices are concerned. And these are the years where we saw huge inflationary pressures as a result of the major energy contributor being controlled like this, as a result of hostilities taking place in the Arab nations, and beyond the Arab nations, actually, in the area, I should say. So, indeed, these are the times that led to huge inflationary pressures. In the US, we had a period of stagflation. In the 80s, we had huge monetary policy interventions that were successful for a number of reasons, but they were there to sort of take away some of the inflationary pressures that had happened in the 70s.
So the price of oil went up almost overnight, which meant the price of almost everything else went up almost overnight.
Absolutely.
Which led to inflation. How did policy makers react back in the 1970s, and what have they learned since then?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. It's very, very little that, you know, monetary policy authorities, those authorities in charge of inflation, can do when you have such a what we call it, a supply shock. The motivation behind this shock is not monetary. There is a conflict in an area. They control the supply of petrol, and, you know, changing the interest rate is not going to resolve conflicts. Political decisions, possibly wars, solve conflicts. So monetary policy can do very little there. But what we did see in the 80s is that we had Paul Volcker, actually, the president of the Fed, who actually just recently died, in fact, who actually went in and, you know, with real interventions in the American economy to try and bring and control inflation and move away from what was called then stagflation, high unemployment, and high inflation. This was a successful policy, and certainly we know that with the benefit of hindsight. But at the time, the 80s were difficult times because we had to put up with both high unemployment and very high inflation, and required huge breaks on the system. This isn't something that we want to go back to. I mean, if the current oil prices that we see today, as we're going to move in to discuss today's events, result in inflationary pressures, and I do not know that they will, but if they were to result in inflationary pressures, you know, there would be very little that monetary authorities across the world can do conflicts can only be resolved by political decisions.
Nicholas, do you share this pessimism? How much has the world changed since the 1970s?
Oh, quite a lot. And just to be focusing in the way the world changed on oil, I think one important change that we've seen in the last 10, 15 years was the rise of the United States is now the biggest supplier of oil. So this was driven by the invention or like the evolution of the fracking technology, which now allows the U.S. to get to oil sources that were not accessible before. And now the U.S. is actually an exporter of oil, and it's the biggest producer. And this has decreased the importance of the traditional oil supporters of the Middle East. And it's kind of the question now, what would happen if we have an escalation in Iran? How much would this actually move the oil prices? Are we going to see high oil prices as we've seen mid of the century? Mid of the decade in 2013? Or are we actually, is this actually the new equilibrium? Is something around 70, which probably be manageable?
It's very difficult to forecast the price of oil. This is the one thing that, it's futile. One should not attempt to forecast that. One needs to do is prepare for contingency scenarios if it were indeed to escalate quite in the way that we've seen in the 70s. But I think I agree here with Nicholas that, you know, the world is quite different today. Can we really do something about that? Also, one needs to talk about this issue in the context of the energy transition, because I think we are indeed in a very different world today than we were in the 70s. We are now actively thinking about ways of moving away from fossil fuels into something much more renewable. So, you know, maybe this is just a nudge to maybe go faster in the energy transition than otherwise. But who knows?
Nicholas, if America is now the world's leading producer of oil, does that mean they might gain from a spike in prices?
Some might gain, but I think so. You always have the suppliers and the demanders. No, you have the people that buy the oil, that drive the cars, that drive the trucks, and you have the people that produce. And what's called the resource curse is actually that in most countries there's just very few people producing the resources. So what you see in countries like Saudi Arabia or Iran, Nigeria, and so on, you can see that basically the people that control resources, they gain a lot from high oil prices. And basically, the general public, they gain very little. And the same might be true in the U.S. If the oil prices rise, people in Texas that actually have access to oil resources that mine the oil, they will benefit from this. But the general American population will not. And I think this points to like the geopolitical dimension of oil. That actually we've seen 2014, the oil price collapsed quite a lot. This has actually led to the collapse of the regime in Venezuela. It has led to a lot of geopolitical problems in Russia and this kind of countries that really depend on oil revenues. And the question now, if the oil price changes, this will also change kind of the power dynamics that we see internationally.
Is it fair to say that Europe has a lot more to lose from a conflagration in the Gulf than America, economically speaking?
We are very, very much closer to the country. So we've seen, it's one thing is the oil price, and there's also some oil producing countries in Europe. The Dutch, the English, the Norwegians, they will gain from a higher price, but most people will not. But more importantly, are they basically how close the Middle East is? And if we see more conflict, we will see more refugees. We will see more pressure on politics in Europe. Syrian civil war is a proxy war, kind of between Saudi Arabia, U.S., this kind of coalition, and Iran. And if this escalates and this will affect more countries, you will see more refugees and more political pressure.
So I agree with Nicholas on this. I mean, Europe is geographically close, and therefore you will see that some of the geographical implications of an escalated conflict in the area. Economically, I think there are some countries who are oil producers, but they're much smaller in this respect, certainly by comparison to the U.S. So therefore the benefits, because as Nicholas said, the producers benefit from it, they're much smaller. And yet all of us are consumers of oil, and therefore an increase in the price of oil will affect us, no doubt. But maybe that is the extra nudge that we need to sort of try and think about alternatives way of energy production and more renewable sources. And therefore, to try and sort of, you know, peter out some of the effects of a possible oil increase price.
Because one of the things that startled me this year was that there was a drone strike thought to be orchestrated by an Iranian militia on some oil facilities in Saudi Arabia. I think it was in the summer of last year, and it was just a few drones, and it in one night it pushed the price of oil up quite significantly and had quite a dramatic effect on global supply. And it was so easy for such a small number of people to do that so quickly. And it's amazing to me how vulnerable the global energy system is to this
kind
of thing.
Still remains, indeed. Mm. Yeah, that is in fact a very good point, and it would remain so. I mean, to the extent that the oil producer countries are in an area where you have the possibility of conflict being quite so easy, then yes, indeed, it's going to affect that. The question is, and there I think there is a big difference from the 70s, as we rely on oil a lot less now than we did back then, and that is the only, if you like, weapon that we have against, that can protect ourselves against sort of a sharp increase, a daily sharp increase on price.
Because about 6 years ago, we had quite a dramatic fall in the oil price. How did that affect regular people?
Well, again, through the same channels that Nicholas described earlier, on the consumer side, it is the price of petrol, so we're heating our houses to the extent that we rely still on petrol to heat our houses or to run our cars. They went down, and that, of course, helps the consumer. But in terms of revenues for countries, Scotland, Norway, the Netherlands, we rely more on gas than petrol. They saw the byproducts of petrol. They saw as of a reduction in their revenues. And I think that, you know, can this be compensated for other things? I mean, that would be part of the national policy.
Mm. Obviously, Europe itself has a lot of energy dependency on Russia at the moment, as well as other things. What kind of policies can people in Brussels follow to help us become more independent on this continent in the meantime, in the next decade or so?
The new president of the European Commission, one of the first things she said was that this European Commission is going to be a geopolitical commission. So quite clearly, the geopolitics, and in fact, Nicholas described those, how they are affected by petrol, is going to be at the top of her agenda, top of all policymakers in Brussels. I think the biggest issue is the political aspect of, you know, what is the European stance on the politics that we are currently seeing. What do we think about the US aggression? What do we think about retaliations in the area? And of course, how this will feed into European grounds. That's the one thing. The other thing is the energy issue. I mean, how are we going to try and disassociate ourselves from the dependence on oil? What are we going to do in the short term and in the long term, more sustainable, to try and move away from such, if you like, weak points, weaknesses in the system? If the energy transition, which is, I think, another very important point in the current commission, is as important as it sounds, then we are going to try and sort of distance ourselves from energy dependence on oil. And I think that is a good thing.
That was always going to have to happen eventually, wasn't it, Nick?
Yeah, I think this is the geopolitical argument for like the green transition, that we make ourselves independent of this kind of regimes. Right now, we need support. It's kind of between Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's always the question, which is worse? And we as an alliance, as the NATO, through the US mostly, we support the Saudi Arabia. We're in a coalition with them, and it's, I think, an uncomfortable coalition. They murder people. They in Turkey, they murdered a journalist. They torture people in their prisons. It's not a good regime in the sense, in the same way that Iran is not. And I think in the moment we become more independent of fossil fuel imports from these countries, we also can strengthen our agenda on other points, and we become more independent from this geopolitical regime.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just the economics needs to be distanced from the politics. Yes. And, you know, we can be captured by the politics and sort of de-jeopardize the economics. And I think this is what's interesting. I mean, you could even take this argument further and say that we are even captured by U.S. decisions when it comes to this. I mean, you know, God knows what the motives behind the current U.S. Mm-hmm. action is. Do we really need to be involved in mm-hmm. it? Why should we make ourselves vulnerable to a discussion in the U.S. that may not actually, you know, have anything to do with us? But it is through oil. It is our dependence on energy why what the U.S. decides to do affects us. And the only way to avoid something like this, well, I mean, other than sort of communicate with the U.S. and understand what it is they're doing, is to try and make ourselves independent from that. So, you know, irrespective of what the politics are and what political decisions Europe does, we should not be vulnerable to the economics. There are ways of protecting ourselves. And, you know, the energy transition is the obvious one.
Mm. Now, speaking of dependence and independence, this did get me thinking about NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and how viable it might be if, for instance, European nations weren't so keen to get involved in something and if the Americans insisted that we did. And one of the things that's come out of this is that European nations weren't informed before this happened that it was going to happen, and that it might push them together in terms of them having their own kind of geopolitical strategy.
Well, yeah, again, I mean, I think, you know, irrespective of what the political decisions are in terms of participate in a conflict, I mean, you know, here we're talking about how much does European economy depend or not depends on oil and what it can do to move away from it. The NATO alliance, you know, they won't be the first one that the US decides to do something that others don't agree with. I mean, we've seen this before on multiple occasions, actually. So, you know, a European refusal to participate in a future conflict is not a strange thing to do. The question is what happens with the economics, because the price of oil will be affected whether we like it or not. And it will affect our consumers, as Nicolas said, and it will affect our producers, namely that they will receive less revenues. You know, what is the future here? I mean, how can we sort of reduce that dependence and therefore allow our politics to be done based on other criteria? I think that's an important thing.
Maybe to add to this, I think there's like two areas which are quite poignant, I think, at the time with regard to energy politics and our dependence on the US. The first one is the JCPOA, so the Iran nuclear deal, which is, as of today, officially dead now.
The Iranians
also will not follow it anymore, where the Europeans wanted to save it and the Americans just basically withdrawn from the treaty. And there was very little that Europe can do because through secondary sanctions, so basically America saying, if you trade with Iran, we will not allow you, give you access to our markets, which for every big European company, it's a non-question. No, if you decide between Iran and US, yeah, you always go with US. And the second one, I think, is Nord Stream, which is basically a pipeline between Russia and Germany for gas. And actually, US has now sanctioned German companies for building this pipeline. And there, the European Commission is also against this pipeline, but it's also a question of energy sovereignty. There, the US is basically telling Europeans you should conduct different energy policy than you're doing now.
Indeed, it comes back to the sovereignty. I mean, the sovereignty are, you know, what we call European sovereignty. Mm. So it's going to be the, I think, the issue of the decade, actually. So, you know, how does Europe ensure that it can make its own sovereign decisions when it comes to politics without having to rely on the US? I mean, I think this issue of the Iraq sanctions, the Iran sanctions are really interesting, how European firms conform to US decisions, mm-hmm. no question asked, because simply the economic interests are such. You know, why is it that European countries still support the Iran deal then on mm-hmm. the nuclear side, and yet firms do not? Is the incentives, and I think this is the bit that this is a square, this is a circle that we need to sort of close. But you know, we are very far from having the arguments or indeed the tools, instruments to establish and guarantee European sovereignty, and this is going to be in the ways that we are describing here, and I think that's going to be something to think about in the future.
Well, it makes me wonder if multilateralism can survive polarization, because how can you make these kind of international deals that are supposed to last for decades across oceans when you have these kind of polarized political parties where you make a deal with one government, then they get overturned by some party that thinks the exact opposite way and they overturn the deal. We saw this with the transatlantic trade partnership and the specific trade partnership as well. So you can have this beautiful agreement that you think solves all these problems, and then a year later it's not worth the paper it's printed on. So can multilateralism survive in this new political climate?
Yeah, indeed. I think that's a very good point. I think multilateralism requires continuity. I mean, you need to have regimes that can transcend political parties. Because as a nation, when you sign a deal as a nation, you sign it as a nation, not as a political party. And therefore, you know, to go back on these types of agreements, these global agreements, as it were, it really is very disturbing in terms of the way that we do business with each other. And the nuclear deal is the case in point here, because it also has repercussions of escalation. And I think, you know, while I condone what the Iranians have decided this morning, I also think it's the necessary decision and the only thing they can do that they have in their hands. So, you know, we are feeding into escalation process, and which is actually quite dangerous. I mean, you know, they will be investing on nuclear armament when we should have nuclear disarmament. Mm. I think this is a very, very dangerous thing. It reminds us of Dr. Strangelove and you know, an era that we thought we were beyond. The 1980s and, you know, the fall of the of the wall, all of these things, they are behind us, and yet, you know, we are back to similar stories. It's going to be a potentially dangerous world.
And I think when we go to the 1990s, there's the argument to go back to the oil crisis. There's the argument we made that oil price was one of the contributing factors to the decline of the Soviet Union. So the 80s were a time of low oil prices. Soviet Union remained a lot on foreign currency from our revenues from oil price. And with the decline of the oil price, they had to reform and they didn't manage to.
Indeed. So in some ways, the oil controlling the oil price was an instrument to try and sort of weaken the enemy, if I may call it this way. So it is an instrument. The way you weaken that instrument, the more you weaken that instrument, the more you allow for sort of incentive compatible arguments to function. So, I think moving away from oil dependence is one way of doing it, since the balance of powers now is shifting.
One wonders if in the years and decades ahead, things like data and the components that make up microchips will replace oil as the supply you control to influence geopolitics.
Indeed, data, some argue, is the new oil for exactly those reasons.
Well, anyway, I hope you enjoyed the first Sound of Economics of the year. Hopefully it won't be the last and we'll get through this crisis. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for listening. Good luck.